Welcome, everyone, to the Split Screen Podcast, the official podcast of BlankPageBeatdown.com. My name is Shah Shahid, and this is the podcast where we compare film remakes with their source material in order to discover the similarities, expose the differences, and provide insight to put it all into context. On this episode, we're actually comparing two rival shared universe film franchises that are on, let's say, varying levels of commercial and critical successes. Obviously, I'm talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, woo, and the DC Extended Universe, yay. Joining me today is returning guest James Amatuzio. Now, keep in mind, this episode was recorded from earlier, prior to the release of Black Panther, which is why it's not featured in our discussion. However, what's really cool is that you'll actually find some of the box office rankings that we discuss still hold true to this day since the recording. Now, this episode arrives just in time to celebrate the release of Justice League on home video, a Blu-ray or DVD. You can buy the movie from Amazon using the link in our show notes to help support the show further. We do get a bit of a kickback, as they say. No, that's a bad word. It's more of like a commission. We're an affiliate. But again, that's if you want. If you're a physical media person like I am, I don't do any digital media. I prefer to have my DVDs. I prefer to hold them, look through all the cover art and everything else. Also, I'm a bit of a hoarder, so I think that plays into that. But enough dilly-dallying. I give you episode 38 of the Split Screen Podcast, the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus the DC Extended Universe with James Amatuzio. Enjoy. With us today is a returning guest, Mr. James Amatuzio. How's it going, James?
Hey, I'm great. How are you? Thanks for having me on, man.
Thank you for making the time, as always. I know it's kind of always hard to kind of schedule this in during the Christmas season and all that.
Always. You know, I just find time between my various games of HQ at this point.
Exactly.
My whole life is scheduled.
Well, hopefully, when you do make it, you win that game, you get that couple of, what is it, $100, $1,000? you still think of the little people like us to come back on the show.
You know it.
So, this episode, like I mentioned, is going to be a little bit of a different approach. We are going to kind of go a little deep cuts, a little, you know, down the rabbit hole. The inspiration behind this episode, we're essentially going to be comparing the Marvel Cinematic Universe with the DC Extended Universe. And the inspiration for the show came about after the sort of performance of the DC Extended Universe's culmination of the superhero model into the Justice League movie, which for us was, at the time of this recording, has been recently released, and ended up being quite the disappointment for almost everybody involved, I'm going to say. It's one of the lowest grossing box office of the entire DCU franchise. Expectation-wise, not for the studios, not for audiences, not for fans. It didn't quite hit the mark in any way whatsoever. And I felt that it was time to kind of take a look at both these franchises, not from a critical perspective of, not from the subjective creative perspective of, you know, this is better because Batman and no Iron Man and because the internet is full of that. So I thought we'd kind of step back and take a look at the sort of the business behind it all, the history behind both the franchises, relating it to their comic book sort of history as companies as well, and seeing how they're both doing, why they're so wildly different, both in critical reception and box office performances. During the research for this show, I found some very surprising things about both these franchises that I didn't know before. I don't know if this is common knowledge, but that's kind of what brought this on. Further to that also, Christopher Nolan, director of probably the best superhero franchise ever directed, I'm going to say, you know, arguably, the Dark Knight franchise with Christian Bale. He recently did a quote regarding this situation of, you know, the MCU and why they're kicking ass versus the DCEU and why they're kind of the disappointment of the third child in, like, the movie cinematic world. And he has a quote. He said something that really made me go, you know what, this is worth exploring. And the quote is, and I'll quote verbatim, when asked about, you know, why his movies were more successful or better than the current trend of things, he essentially discussed the fact that he had a luxury that these other films don't have at this moment, the luxury of time. And he goes on to say, and I quote, That's a privilege and a luxury that filmmakers aren't afforded anymore. I think it was the last time that anyone was able to say to a studio, I might do another one, but it will be 4 years. There's too much pressure on release schedules to let people do that now, but creatively it's a huge advantage. We had the privilege and advantage to develop as people and as storytellers and then bring the family back together. End quote. This is in reference to the fact that between every Batman movie that Christopher Nolan did make, he also had the freedom and the time to go off, make a totally different movie. In the case of Batman Begins, right after, he followed that up with The Prestige, I believe. James will obviously correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
And then he returned to do The Dark Knight, right? The Dark Knight, which he then also took a break from and did Inception. And then he returned with The Dark Knight Rises. So he had that freedom of saying, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do one for me. One for you, one for me. Which a lot of directors do adapt, but for some reason, it's not given to the superhero movie model, for some reason. So given that, I thought it was kind of fitting and might be a little bit insightful. I mean, I'm probably being presumptuous. This episode could end up being a, you know, like, they're just talking about nonsense we know already. but that's kind of the goal behind this episode. So before we obviously get into all of it, we're going to be talking about all the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. We're going to try to stay away from the critical reception of why Hulk is funnier in Ragnarok versus the Incredible Hulk with Edward Norton. We're going to stay away from those kind of fan debates. But suffice to say, there will be maybe some spoilers that will get dropped here and there with, you know, maybe Ragnarok and some of the other more recent releases. So fair warning, spoiler warning for both the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well as the DC Extended Universe, which does include Justice League. Now, if you're on a comic book fan, you don't know that the DC versus Marvel thing is a big thing in comics. I remember I grew up with it, James. I don't know about you, but I grew up with the whole, are you a DC man or are you a Marvel man? I'm saying man, we were boys at the time.
Yeah.
But me personally, I always kind of related to the kind of stories that DC told versus Marvel. I don't know why. I don't know. I can't quantify, because any example I would give you of why I like DC, I'm sure there's going to be an example of that in the Marvel comic book world as well. So I, for whatever reason, just related to DC more. James, were you on a side? Did you kind of experience that whole kind of schism growing up yourself?
Not really. Not in the sense where you were asked directly, like, are you specifically a Marvel or a DC guy? Like,
there's like clicks, there's like Grease Lightning happening.
Right, yeah, like you have to have the leather jacket with a patch on it in order to even discuss what comic books you're reading. No, I come at it from a completely different way. I didn't really grow up with comic books, per se.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first comic book that I ever owned was, I bought the entire, going loosely on the definition of comic book, I'm going to go with graphic novel from here on out, I bought the entire Sin City collection, because that, I think, was my first foray into it, was Robert Rodriguez's Sin City movie, and that hooked me onto the comic, or onto the graphic novel series, so I bought them all immediately and read them all, and then from there I bridged off to various random Batman ones. So I guess if you want to say, I've always been on the DC side of graphic novels or comic books. I haven't really dabbled on Marvel's side until very, very recently, where I read a Daredevil comic.
Nice.
But up until then, it was definitely DC, and I think you have a point there where it sort of resonates more with people. It's a little bit more down to earth, I want to say, maybe, on the DC side, where, like, it's not, I don't know, like, Marvel always seems so fantastical and so wild, whereas DC always felt a little bit more grounded, especially with, like, Batman being the main sort of guy, and Superman obviously being a god, but even, like, everything was still grounded on Earth, in a way.
And I find, like, even the content, like, for example, like, you can't separate any story, like, the concept of Superman, you can't separate that concept from the concept of humanity, because it always felt like that was the moral of his story, the fact that this alien was more human than human sometimes. I can't think of an inherent Marvel comic book property, and again, I'm sure we'll get tweets, you know, yelling at us otherwise, but through personal experience, I can't see anything that related that. I can't see these two concepts going side by side in any other thing. The X-Men stories for sure was an allegory for, you know, growing up and racism and you know, the Civil War culture. The Civil War storyline in Marvel Comics was, I thought, one of the best storylines ever with what it did. But again, unfortunately, that storyline doesn't work unless you're already a comic book fan. With all these heroes and all these, you know, multiple superheroes coming together and having this fight about, you know, civil liberties and human rights and or mutant rights or whatever you want to call it. So it's just whereas, like, you can pick up a DC graphic novel or those one-shot or those standalone stories and can just kind of go like, oh, I get what the message of this story was. With Marvel, I've always found it to be like more, my reaction whenever I read a Marvel one-off or anything else was always like, oh, who's that guy? Oh, who's this guy?
Right.
And it was
yeah.
kind of like all these auxiliary characters that had important story beats, and I was more distracted by that and their powers and what they could look like or what they did than following the story. Whereas it was kind of like, you know, this is Batman and he's a human being and he has powers despite, sorry, he doesn't have powers, but he does the right thing despite not having, like, their stories are connected to their weaknesses or their limitations or like a moral story at the end of it. So I don't know, whatever. I feel like we can do this over and over again, and I'm sure, again, like I said, this is a whole debate that has been going on for a long time. Obviously now with the way fandom has developed with films, you've got people that have never read a comic book that watch a movie and are a fan of that property, which is great, which is, you know, which is amazing because it's the age of the geek now, right? But at the same time now, we've also evolved as fanboys and we have a different debate now of, you know, the DCEU versus the MCU, which is unfair in a lot of ways. But from, again, standing back and taking a look at the release schedule and the business perspective and the approaches, we live in a world now when, you know, if a director wants to put "the" in front of a title and has a conversation about it in a boardroom, that becomes, you know, news picked up by 7 different outlets the next day. So given that, what is your take so far on this shared universe concept when it comes to comic book properties?
I think in terms of comic book properties, I think it lends itself very well, mainly because it's coming from that whole graphic novel era too, where you would work on a few different stories and you'd end up having characters cross over into different properties and seeing this person show up in this novel and this one crossing over to that one or a big team up thing. And I think it lends really well if it's done properly. And I want to say that, like, I think you and I are probably the two better people to approach this, because I don't think you and I will ever go, oh, are you an MCU or a DCEU person? I think we come at it more of like, we just are movie people.
Well, I like everything. Like, I'm
exactly.
I mean, I don't know much about the Potter thing to say I'm a, what is that, Pothead?
Potterhead? Potterhead?
What do you call yourselves?
Potterhead.
Right, Potter.
Oh man.
So,
yeah, sure. That's fine.
Yeah, like, I don't know enough about that franchise to call myself you know, like a hardcore fan. But I like the stories. I've read all the books. I've watched all the movies. So I mean, there's so many fandoms now to kind of, I don't see the point of differentiating anymore. I don't get the point of, like, you know, this is better than that, or yeah, sure. I mean, everything has problems.
Sure.
You know, there's many MCU movies that have problems. The MCU has an overarching problem, you know, story wise, fictionally, writing wise. But I find it kind of, you know, diminutive to kind of dismiss it like that. But in terms of, like, I know you said, like, you and I both resonated more to DC. Obviously, the MCU was the, I mean, they weren't the first people to do a shared universe. Universal had a shared monsters universe, you know, decades before that.
Sure.
But bringing this comic book reality into the silver screen, into with films and having a shared continuity, how do you feel about, you know, just generally an overview of the Marvel Cinematic Universe? What do you think about it so far?
So far, with the way that it's heading, it's been a fun ride. It's had its ups and downs. We've sort of, if everyone is kept up with every single movie that they put out, like, you can clearly see sort of like a trend. There's definitely shifts in the way that the movies are coming out, but the way that they've handled the overall universe and the way that they're doing their release schedule, the way that it's sort of culminated and made sense in a way where, like, you're able to follow the whole thing that's going on without too much help. Like, it's been well developed. You grow with every single one of these characters, and I think that's what I've enjoyed the most about it, is that none of these people are, like, unfamiliar to me. They all carry a lot of weight, and I think that's just been because, you know, we're almost up to 10 years now that this has been going on, and it's incredible the amount of movies that they've put out and the amount of time and effort that they've put into making sure that everything sort of lines up and makes sense and is in the right spot.
And do you find again, a lot of people talk about superhero fatigue. Have you personally found out? I mean, the box office obviously says otherwise. But have you personally felt like superhero fatigue? Have you felt like, oh my god, this is way too many superhero movies in a year, way too many superhero movies in general, too many characters to keep track of? Do you find that the shared universe at one point, because that's essentially the biggest problem in the comic book world, right? Every couple of years, the comic book world has to reset itself, has to tell new stories, has to kind of go back to year zero, because they're getting to a point where they tell, you know, 10 years of stories, and now no new audience member can jump in, because everything is a established storyline. You have to read XYZ before you can follow ABC, kind of a thing. Do you find that the movies, specifically the MCU, because they have a lot more movies than the DCEU, do you find the MCU is getting there, or is at the risk of getting to that stage?
I think they're close at this point. But again, with like the things that they have planned, they keep... It seems like it's going to start changing, and they're at a point where they're going to have to start phasing out some things in order to keep stories fresh and keep things new and keep things inventive. A really good case of that would be, you know, the introduction of Spider-Man and Civil War, and then, you know, his own movie that wasn't your typical origin story, so to speak. Like, it didn't go back in time. Like, we just sort of picked up where it was and just... Mm. It is what it is. We're not doing this. We're not rehashing Uncle Ben's death. We're going right through to it and just getting into it. Like, you know he's Spider-Man. We know he's Spider-Man. You know what? Well, like, let's watch him grow as a high school kid instead.
Right.
So I think if they keep that sort of that trend going where they can pick up new storylines or new ideas, it will keep things fresh and stop the fatigue from happening. If they keep rehashing old things where it's constantly three movies and a team-up movie, that's going to get really tiring, and we're sort of running low on the single stories. I mean, there's definitely different ways that they can go, but how much of it would be accessible to a general audience is a tough, tough thing to balance.
And I mean, and speaking from, like, monetary perspective, I mean, Homecoming, like you kind of mentioned, it's one of the newer things that they tried. It's currently number 6 in terms of the MCU's ratings when it comes to the amount of money it made at the box office.
Yep.
So
yeah.
Clearly the numbers are there. Clearly people are following along with this model of, you know, we don't need an origin story. You don't need to start from scratch. You can introduce something halfway through, continue that story in a totally different movie, in a totally different place, and the money's there. The money is moving from that to the next. Now, in terms of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, obviously we know that it started with Iron Man back in 2008. We're coming up on the 10th year of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Since then, since 2008, we've had 17 releases of all interconnected stories set in the same universe, dealing with, you know, the same sort of reality and whatnot. Sometimes we even go to space. And this will all culminate with Avengers Infinity War coming next year, so marking sort of the 10-year culmination of this model. And they've had lots of success. How did you feel about that first phase, James? Was that, like, for me personally, I was overjoyed. I was excited. Even to this point, I mean, it's been almost 10 years. And, you know, when there's a casual audience member that maybe have not following all these movies, or they know that there's an Iron Man, they know there's an Avengers, they know there's a Hulk, but they kind of maybe not understand that it's all the same universe. That's kind of how I pitch it to them. I'm like, it's all the same. They're all going to meet each other and have fun. and general audience are usually like, oh, that's cool. I had no idea. So and then the follow-up usually is, do I need to watch that? And I'm like, well, it's funner, but you don't need to. What was your reaction to this, to the MCU? Like, how do you feel like the stories that the MCU tells, why are they so popular with general audiences? Why are they so accessible? Because prior to 2008, the kid next door didn't know who Iron Man was, didn't know who Thor was, you know? These are usually auxiliary characters. These aren't signature characters of Marvel. Spider-Man was a signature character of Marvel. The Fantastic Four, you know, the first family of Marvel. These characters that now we all know and love, that people dress up as, kids dress up as during Halloween, these guys weren't well known before the movies. Do you find that that's more of a creative sort of success story for them, or is it more branding at this point?
I think, honestly, going back to Iron Man being the first one in this well-planned and well-thought-out universe that started, like, with Kevin Feige pitching this back in 2005, I think without Iron Man and to that end, without Robert Downey Jr., this probably wouldn't have worked as successful as it did. He brought this, like, crazy accessible character to everyone. Like, even if you didn't know Iron Man, you were compelled to watch him. He has this charisma about him that was different and new, and you didn't quite understand where it was going, and it didn't feel... Like, I mean, this was 2008. It didn't really feel like any other comic book movie that I had seen before. Mm-hmm. It was jokey. It was fun. It was... It had a garbage load of action in it that was just way over the top and crazy. And it was still an origin story at the end of the day. It was just, at its heart, it's a basic origin story.
And a hero that was far from heroic.
Yes. Yeah. Like, your anti-hero, really. Like, you didn't almost want him to win at points, because you're just like, man, this guy's created a company that's just awful. But like, seeing his discovery of everything and having Robert Downey Jr. act through all of that, creating a suit, you know, being kidnapped and all of that, I think that brought people in, because it didn't feel like a comic book movie per se. Like, he wasn't fighting this big bad arch enemy guy until the very, very end, when it was just, you know, Iron Man versus bigger Iron Man. But, like, I think that's what really helped it. Whereas, like, Batman, it was like, oh, well, Batman's dealing with Scarecrow and Ra's al Ghul or the Joker. Like, again, these are huge, huge enemies.
Yeah.
But Iron Man was dealing with himself. It was like an internal conflict until the end, when he figured out what the heck was going on at his company. I think that... Yep.
Now, just to kind of peel back the layer a little bit, you know, look behind the screen. You did mention that Robert Downey is kind of one of the reasons why this thing was such a big thing. And let's be fair, Robert Downey Jr. is playing Robert Downey Jr. in the movie. it was a stroke of genius that you got the one actor to play a character that essentially mirrors that actor's, you know, own personal history. Now, I would say that you also bring up, you know, Kevin Feige. There's obviously stories about the fact that everybody involved had to fight to get Robert Downey this role, because at the time he wasn't really bankable. There's a lot of problems for him as an actor, you know, some issues and getting along. I mean, he's had a history of substance abuse, and he was he was a bad boy. So they had to sell him. They had to sell the studio at that point. At that time, there was no Marvel Studios. I think Iron Man was the first film under that banner, of the Marvel Studios banner. It wasn't even called Marvel Studios. It was just Marvel. And they had to sell him. And they didn't want to pay him scale. They didn't want to pay him anything. I think Jon Favreau kind of championed casting Robert Downey in this role. And since then, I feel like, I mean, you hear every year that, you know, after every movie, that Robert Downey's not going to do this anymore, or he's going to step back a bit more, or he's going to, you know, just do guest appearances. But every time you hear these stories, his next appearance ends up being a full-blown, you know, so-and-so superhero and Iron Man. You know, Captain America Civil War became Captain America Civil War with Iron Man. He gets enough significance and space and screen time where you're kind of like, well, this is almost like an Iron Man movie, more or less, or... You know, there's no backseat that we've really seen. So do you find that, me personally, do you find that that's kind of, again, just kind of going behind the scenes, that is what essentially kickstarted the whole thing? The fact that you got an actor with the veteran status, history, and skill as Robert Downey Jr. to play a character that people that know Robert Downey Jr. can watch and be like, oh, this is very meta. Like, he's a prick like this in real life sometimes. And then you add more characters to that dynamic, and he's again continuously. It's a story beat in the MCU now, right? Where Iron Man, Tony Stark does whatever the hell he wants, screw everyone else.
And I mean, like with Robert Downey Jr., like as you said, like it was casting where you casted someone to basically play themselves, and that's a perfect idea. Like, why not try to get someone that's as close to their human counterpart as possible? Just outside of that, like, you saw basically what Ryan Reynolds had to go through for Deadpool. But I mean, mm-hmm. you cast someone that is that character, basically, who can sort of embody that in real life, and it clicks on a different level, and it makes things more accessible, because it feels more natural. It's not someone trying to act like Captain America. Not saying that Chris Evans is a bad Captain America by any means, but
let's go, like, with Thor. I think Thor is a better example of someone trying to be something they're not.
Right, where you, especially in the first two Thors, where you're casting someone like Chris Hemsworth to play a Shakespearean Thor, it feels off. Like something's just
Especially when we now know that the guy is a lot more comfortable being charming and silly and goofy
and super funny,
right? Like, instead of being like, you know, thou dost burn to my eggs or something.
Yeah, yeah. Another through a coffee mug. Like it was. It's. I think that's what that really will set the difference. Is if you can find someone that's going to be as close to the person as they are in real life, it makes all the difference and brings this natural ability to them where it's so accessible and so easily watchable because you just want to see them be that person.
And that credit directly at this point in 2008 with Iron Man, that credit goes to Jon Favreau.
Favreau.
Favreau. So obviously he did Iron Man 2, and to a point in the first phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Jon Favreau did stay on. He was essentially, I'm going to use the term Godfather because it does tie into something else we're going to talk about later. But eventually, obviously for creative differences or whatever the case was, he did take a back seat to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In the beginning, he was part of all the writers' rooms. He was kind of helping all the directors. I believe he gave notes to Kenneth Branagh for the Thor movie. I believe he kind of worked with Joe Johnson for the first Avenger, Captain America. But eventually, Jon Favreau, even though he starred in the movies as Happy Hogan, the Iron Man movies, the Avengers movies, and so on, he did kind of take a backseat from that role, from the role of overseer or sort of godfather of the thing that, you know, in many ways he created along with Kevin Feige. Do you find, especially because we're talking about the DC Extended Universe, do you find that behind the scenes of Marvel, this constant creative changes, them bringing in directors that specifically can deal with certain subject matter. Again, phase one, you had a director that kind of suited the movie they were making. Kenneth Branagh, Shakespearean actor, you know, theater actor, great director, was brought in to do a movie about, you know, Shakespearean characters like Thor. You had Joe Johnson, who was in more or less an action movie thriller sort of a director at that time, brought in to do Captain America the First Avenger. So on. Do you find that the behind the scenes of the MCU kind of, what do you think they did to kind of keep that going, to make the MCU what it is today?
I think honestly, like from a creative standpoint at that time, I think they were sourcing sort of the best minds that would fit with their comic book properties that they were looking to adapt. Jon Favreau was a great example, especially for the first Iron Man, for creating this dialogue that wasn't too over the top. It was laid back, a little bit more down to earth, and flowed with what Robert Downey Jr. was able to bring to screen. Kenneth Branagh, as you said, like brought a great Shakespearean performance from Thor, and delivered on that sense. I mean, if you're looking at it straight from the Shakespearean point of view, really Shakespearean.
On paper, that was a great choice. Yeah. On paper, when you see the movies Kenneth Branagh did up until that point, and you think of what Thor would be, again, this is before we actually saw the movie, you go, oh my god, yeah, this is perfect. This makes the most sense on paper. You know, again, staying away from the critical reception, it still made money. I just noticed, again, like you and I always constantly, I mean, I did not like the first Thor movie. It's just personal experience. But if you look at the worldwide box office, I believe the first Thor movie made more money than the first Avenger, which surprised me when I first found out about that, because that didn't make any sense to me. But clearly, people were more receptive to Thor than they were to Captain America.
Yeah, and I think they were trying to go with that whole, well, if we can find someone that works with that property, that's who we'll keep, and that's going to be Jon Favreau. He's going to be doing Iron Man. That's it. Right. We got him on Iron Man. This is going to be great. If we can get Kenneth Branagh on Thor, perfect. If we can get Joe Johnson to do all the Captain Americas, that'd be great. And I think that's what they were sort of trying, at least in the beginning, trying to figure out their footing. And at that time, the release schedule also was really quick.
Yeah. The turnaround was really high.
Especially after the first two dropped and they realized sort of how they wanted to plan this out and where it was going to go, it was... we had two in 2008, only one in 2010, but then two in 2011, and then another one in 2012. Like it was picking up speed and getting a lot quicker. And I think that they had they had these people, and they're like, all right, good, locked. So we can get Jean Favreau. He can just start writing the third Iron Man after Iron Man 2 came out.
And then something happened.
Yeah.
Something happened after the phase one of these movies. They brought on, obviously, the golden goose at this point was, we're going to take these four solo hero movies, we're going to tie them into this massive sort of... these five solo hero movies, and we're going to tie them into this massive team-up with the Avengers. They got... to do the Avengers, basically a guy who was a geek god at this time. The director, you know, director, creator, writer, producer, you know, genius Joss Whedon, which, you know, collectively the entire world went, yay! Because also that gave Joss Whedon this sort of legitimate cred that he didn't have up until this point. Up until this point, he was doing his own creator sort of sourced material. He created everything he did. He kind of, you know, Buffy, Dollhouse, Angel, Firefly, Serenity, so on and so on. But this was the first sort of major studio where it's like, here's a gazillion dollars, do what you want to do. And to this day, I think Avengers, in terms of global box office, is up there. I think it's still number one in every respect, worldwide, domestic opening. Every record, I think, is held by the Avengers from a global box office perspective. But something started happening, right, in phase two. These directors, like, as you mentioned, they had locked them in. But people kind of started veering away from this Marvel model. You know, Kenneth Branagh didn't return. And then they got Alan Taylor, I want to say, for Thor: The Dark World.
Yes, yep.
Who is kind of like a True Blood, I think, or Game of Thrones sort of a director, a TV director, and he crapped on this movie and the Marvel model when the movie was coming out during the press. He basically talked about how it was a horrible experience working with this Marvel model of having to forcefully fit your movie into this Marvel hole that, you know, has to connect to the other movies. Avengers, the second Avengers, the culmination of essentially Phase 2, was also Joss Whedon coming back to direct Avengers 2, and there was reports of him essentially being hospitalized through sheer exhaustion of having to deal with making a movie of this scale while trying to keep the studio happy, who constantly had notes, constantly wanted him to do something that he couldn't do or wasn't able to do or was kind of limiting his vision or his creativity. And then Iron Man 3 happened prior to that as well. So there was kind of like this kind of chips in the Marvel plan, right? But obviously, since then, we're back on course. How do you want to credit that? I mean, I personally think it's Kevin Feige. I think right now, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is a Kevin Feige show.
Oh yeah, definitely. That man is, if you want to call someone the architect of this entire thing, it is Kevin Feige from the beginning. That man has been involved with absolutely everything. It was his baby from the start, and I think it really shows that he's also willing to adapt his baby into something that works. Adapt his baby for something that works.
Well, it's a baby adapter, of course.
Yeah, of course. Naturally. But like, I think... No, like, Phase 2, for what it was, I mean, Marvel's The Avengers was, at the end of Phase 1, Marvel's The Avengers was, and still is, the culmination of probably one of the best team-up movies, the best...
Ever.
Yeah, ever, of all time. Mm. But I think if you look back from that and look at, like, the ones that weren't as received, or as well-received, like, with Kenneth Branagh not wanting to come back, Iron Man 2 not being... everything that they had hoped for, even though it did still make quite a sizable amount of coin. Mm-hmm. I think, like, you notice in Phase 2 became a lot more of at least the start of trying to let people, trying to let creative directors be creative. Like, Iron Man 3 was a Shane Black movie through and through. Like, there was... Right. Like, he wasn't brought in and, like, told, okay, well, you have to follow this studio model. He made a Shane Black movie. He made a Shane Black Iron Man 3. The Russo brothers, for their Winter Soldier, made a Russo brothers movie, but it was almost near perfect.
Well, and I mean, and sort of kind of spinning off of that comment, Robert Downey Jr., before he got Iron Man, he did Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
With Shane Black. Yep. And that was the one movie that kind of everyone referred to, right? That was the one movie that brought Robert Downey out of hiding, out of the whatever hole he was crawling into, and made people go, oh, he makes movies still.
Yeah.
And he seems to be good in them, and he seems to be able to wake up on time and go to bed on time to do them. And I think that's what kind of put him in the spotlight for Iron Man. So when they hired Shane Black, and again, at that time, it also kind of felt like Marvel didn't know what the hell they were doing. Because
yes.
Why do you hire a guy like Shane Black? And if you know Shane Black, this is the guy who also wrote and I think created the Lethal Weapon franchise.
Yep.
If you know who you're hiring, you should know what you're getting. Because Shane Black isn't an auteur filmmaker where all his movies differ and you're like, oh my God. Like, he's not a Spielberg. His movies have a pattern, just like Joss Whedon's movies do. There's a pattern where you can watch 10 minutes of this movie and kind of pretty much narrow down two filmmakers that might have done this movie. So, from a Marvel perspective, when you hire a guy like Shane Black and you get a movie like Iron Man 3, what did you think was happening?
Exactly.
So at the time, it kind of felt like you hear all these stories of, you know, the directors dropping out of, you know, the sequel of Thor 2, Captain America 2, and you hear about, you know, Joss Whedon's problems with Avengers, and then you hear about how, you know, audiences hated Iron Man 3, and it wasn't what anyone was expecting, and oh my God, and Shane Black got thrown on the bus, and it was kind of like, no, guys, what were you expecting, though?
Right? Exactly. So you just saw that Shane Black was attached as a director. If you are not familiar with Shane Black's work, I mean, that's kind of on you as a studio. I mean, you put him in that chair and you got exactly what you paid for, which was a Shane Black Iron Man 3, which I simply adore just because.
Yeah. No, I like that too, because again, for me, I was going into that going, I'm going to watch a Shane Black movie that's about Iron Man. And that's what we got. That movie. I mean, again, creatively speaking, he didn't put on the suit once. You know, I mean, in the beginning for 5 minutes, at the end for reference. And it was just kind of like, well, this is what I expect. Cut to today with the MCU, and you're almost at the point where, like, they can do no wrong. They are the juggernauts of this shared superhero universe, and they'll destroy everything in sight. But it's funny that people forget that. People forget that there were so many problems in the beginning. Again, not even speaking critically, just creatively behind the scenes, there's all these issues, you know. And again, like, Joss Whedon's been hospitalized, guys. Like, this was a thing that happened where, you know, a director just couldn't put up with Marvel's system of working, of what they wanted creatively in a movie. And the DCEU, for all its fault, we're not there yet. We haven't had directors be hospitalized. Because of the rigors of working with Warner Brothers. But that's kind of where I want to kind of tie this back into the comparison that we're making essentially with the show, is that the MCU, for as good as it is today, due to Kevin Feige, due to obviously a lot of other people behind the scenes, but mostly Kevin Feige, there was a lot of hiccups. There were a lot of hiccups that people either want to forget or don't want to think about, or just kind of, you know, want to put in the rearview mirror and just kind of move forward, which is fine. All those things are fine. But now we cut to the DCEU. And the DC Extended Universe essentially is only 5 films old. This debuted in 2013 with Man of Steel, which didn't introduce a brand name household actor leading the movie. It introduced Henry Cavill as the iconic Superman, which right off the bat, you know, we talked about Robert Downey, a known actor filling the role of an unknown character. Now we have the opposite with the DCEU, right? Man of Steel featured the most iconic superhero ever. I think you can go into the far reaches of the world and still have people who will know. I'm sure you can discover an unknown tribe that's never been found before somewhere in some corner of the world, and they will still sort of have a familiarity with what Superman is. And you have a guy like that, and the person, you know, to fill those shoes is an actor who isn't relatively known at all. He did The Mortals, I think, at that point. He was in The Two Doors, maybe. So right off the bat, you have the DCU starting off with what you can consider a disadvantage. There's nobody in that movie that rivals the status of Robert Downey Jr. James, what was your take on Man of Steel when it first came out? Critically, box office, what was your take leading up to the movie and then finally getting to see it?
I was excited because there was still, like, beyond just having almost a no-name actor take up the role of Superman at that time, there was big names behind it too. Right. You still had Zack Snyder directing, who at that point was coming off some he still had some good cred from his movies that he's done in the past. You had a story that was done by David S. Goyer and Christopher Nolan, which was like, it's a huge name behind your story as well. In Chris Nolan, you had David S. Goyer, who did the screenplay as well for it. You're coming into a movie with, you know, the actor being unknown, notwithstanding, even watching like the first trailer for Man of Steel, you're like, oh yeah, that guy's Clark Kent. And I think it's sort of another one where I
jacked. That was my reaction.
Yeah,
I'm like, holy huge. Crap, this is a Superman that looks like the Superman from the comic books.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing against Christopher Reeve. I still think he's the best Superman we've gotten to date. Not because of the physicality, but because of the fact that he puts on a piece of fabric and becomes a totally different person. That's why I love Christopher Reeve. But you look at Henry Cavill and you're like, he could just be the guy that they've been using to draw Superman all these years in comic books.
Yes. Yeah, physically he embodied him really well. I thought even like just acting wise, I really do like Henry Cavill as Superman, especially in Man of Steel.
Grew into it eventually, yeah. But that's the thing, right? Like you brought up a really good point. Man of Steel touted itself more on the backs of its behind the scenes team.
Yes.
Then it's on camera. I mean, there was a lot of stars in that movie. Don't get me wrong. There was a lot of known faces in front of the camera.
Sure.
But not in terms of leading the film. They weren't they weren't the male lead, or they weren't the lead female. Like, Amy Adams, great. Amazing actress, up and coming. You put her in that. I think she was coming off of, at that point, the movie with American Hustle, and she had a bunch of kind of stuff she was coming off at the time. So you have her, it gives it some legitimate, you know, acting credibility. You've got, you know, Diane Lane in there. You've got so many sort of heavy hitters supporting the cast around Henry Cavill. But the biggest names were the ones behind the camera. You had Christopher Nolan, who was, you know, sort of quote-unquote godfathering the movie. And this is the comparison that I was going to make with Jon Favreau, is the fact that with the DCEU, that was the frame of reference, right? While Iron Man had Jon Favreau directing and overseeing the beginning of the MCU with Kevin Feige, who at the time, we didn't know who the hell Kevin Feige was.
Yeah, he was just a name.
He was just a guy. He was just a name that was in there. But we knew Christopher Nolan. Why? Because before Man of Steel, the Dark Knight trilogy was what we held as the greatest superhero movie at that time. So now you got this guy and the writer for those movies coming back to write this movie, and that dude who made 300 with the awesome painted abs and action sequences, slow-mo rock sequences, that guy's directing. Like, the names behind the camera sold Man of Steel to the general audiences and to fanboys and everybody else.
Easily.
Now, I didn't look into this, James, but was Man of Steel made with the intention of a cinematic universe?
From what I was gathering, it was a test the waters. It was designed to lay the groundwork of it. But it wasn't necessarily planned out. Like, Kevin Feige went in and got a loan based on the fact that he wanted to create a universe, a shared universe for all of these comic book
properties. We're going to dive into Kevin Feige as well in a couple
of
minutes.
But just as, like, a quick compare, whereas this one was done as, like, so that was back in, like, 2005, before, you know, any film had come out. He already sort of had that idea, whereas this film was written with small references, tiny little details that if it was a success, then they could use it as a shared universe. Yeah. If it wasn't, then they could have just left it as a standalone and we're good.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where that one was.
And essentially Man of Steel, it made enough money to warrant a sequel. Now, like I mentioned earlier, the DC600 universe, in comparison to Marvel Cinematic Universe, is only 5 films old. Now, unfortunately, when we talk about the diversity of the creative team behind the MCU, as James discussed, you've got people they picked to do each movie based on the director's strengths and the qualities of the story that they're going to be telling. Cut to the DCEU, like I said, out of the 5 films, 3 of them directed by the same director. Which, again, is a stark contrast of that perspective of, if you're choosing directors to tell the proper stories that fit their strengths as well as the stories being told, why, out of your five movies, do you have one guy doing majority of them? Not a producer like Kevin Feige, not Christopher Nolan, who's overseeing the project, because I think after Man of Steel, Christopher Nolan more or less was not as involved, despite his production company still being tied to the films. So right away, you see that direct difference of, you know, MCU starting off with, and again, the intention, like James said, was to lock people in. This guy's going to do these movies indefinitely. This guy's going to do this movie indefinitely. Whereas Man of Steel started off with one guy. There didn't seem to be much room to budge. The announcement for the sequel of Man of Steel, and it was weird too, because the announcement of this universe came with this, the sequel to Man of Steel, which had nothing to do with Man of Steel, which was weird. Announced in Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, I believe 2014?
2014, July 2014.
July 2014, you had Zack Snyder and company announce the fact that they're going to be adapting. It's funny that you mentioned, James, your first thing was Sin City, because they were adapting Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns graphic novel and parts of that into this movie, where they were also introducing a brand new Batman, which excited audiences. Confused a lot of us, and we couldn't figure out what was happening, because you went from this Man of Steel movie, which, like you mentioned, James, standalone, bits and pieces of universe to be used if possible, but then you go completely, like, you know, rev, you know, 160 to, like, you know, the next exit to tell something that you're like, there's no seeds of Batman in Man of Steel. There's no, you know, planning, like what happened? Like, how are we building a universe based off something that didn't really, wasn't about that? And then BVS came out, and made crap loads of money. Critically, not that well, but made enough money to warrant this universe to go full steam ahead. Which was followed by then Suicide Squad, which was a team up of supervillains in the DCEU coming together to stop a bigger supervillain. Again, let's not get into the creative fallacies of that idea, but more recently, the prior to the Justice League movie, which inspired this whole thing, Wonder Woman was the movie, the DCEU movie, that introduced the iconic, the epitome of the female superhero, of female empowerment in comic books, Wonder Woman, into the live action feature film, I believe, for the first time, James.
Yes, definitely. Yes,
there was a TV series, obviously, back in the day.
Yeah.
But this is their first feature film debut, and it kicked ass.
Oh, so much.
If that's not an understatement. And not just commercially, creatively. I mean, this movie made money. This movie made bank. This movie made everybody happy. Yes. Not counting those douchebags at the Alamo Drafthouse. And this movie just kind of, you know, for everyone that was kind of doom and gloom about the DCEU thus far, about the fact that Zack Snyder's very divisive brand of filmmaking was dominating this franchise so far, got a breath of fresh air and was like, oh my god, Wonder Woman is amazing. There's things in this movie that we've never seen before. No one's seen before. And do you think that movie made the expectation of Justice League that much more higher?
I definitely think so. I went into Justice League with a much higher expectation of it, because, I mean, what DC has been good at is, oh, not good at, but at least been consistent with, is listening. They may pick up the wrong message in terms of what was critically not liked about most of their films, but at least they're out there listening. And Wonder Woman was like a true change, where it was like, this is DC? Are we sure? Like, this is a DC that you got Patty Jenkins to direct, and the story is different, and it's fun, and it's light, and it's, you know, there's not shadows all over the place where I'm like, why is everyone sort of like looking pale everywhere?
Yeah.
It was different and bright and fun, and I went into Justice League going, yeah, okay, so I think they sort of know where they're going. They're bringing in Wonder Woman into Justice League, so we gotta at least have some similar themes or threads, or at least filmmaking between the two, because you can't go from super light and fun and great to dark and brooding within one movie. And yeah.
And I mean, it, and the fun fact of this trivia of this situation is also that Patty Jenkins, who now is kind of considered as the woman, the person who, if there's any life left in the DCU, it's Patty Jenkins, basically, at this point. And we'll get into why in a second. But what's interesting to me is we talked about the MCU. We talked about the problems of the MCU earlier, and the fact that, you know, when it came to Thor 2, there's, you know, the final director of that movie, you know, completely crapped on its makers, on his bosses. But prior to that guy being the director of Thor 2, Patty Jenkins was confirmed as the director for Thor 2: The Dark World, and I don't remember the time frame, but at one point eventually she did drop out. After her success with Wonder Woman, she did discuss why that happened. She did discuss the fact that there was a creative difference between her ideas of what she wanted to do with Thor 2 versus what she the Marvel bigwigs, you know, i.e. Kevin Feige, wanted the movie to go and what they wanted to do with it. And you wonder a world where this person who's just made a killing with Wonder Woman, you wonder what the MCU would have looked like if this person was involved. On the ground floor, sort of, in phase two. Now, obviously, like we said, you know, she kickstarted expectation and anticipation for the Justice League movie. Now, James, take it away. How did that turn out for all of us?
So with Justice League, I mean, I think, I feel like I went into it with a really good unbiased opinion. I really didn't want to have any bias to it. I mean, I got an advanced screening of it as well, which meant I didn't have to pay to see it either, which I always find tends to sway the way that I look at movies a little bit, because sometimes it's like, oh, man, I paid for it, I gotta find a thing to like about it.
What a brown perspective you just gave us. that how much I pay for something affects how much I like it, obviously, guys.
No, I find, like, I give things more of a benefit of a doubt if I've actually spent money watching it.
It's also, we're trying to spend this show talking about the monetary, the box office, the behind-the-scenes aspect of these movies. And that is a big factor, right? When you are paying money for something, you are investing yourself monetarily even before you see the creativity unfold on screen. Before the story can grab you or get you to invest or commit to it from an emotional standpoint, you've committed financially to seeing this thing through. And that's also where I find, and not to cut you off, James, but when we talk about box office figures of a movie, and we use that as evidence of how the quality of the movie, right? We're using the quantity of the money it made to sort of make a comment on the quality of this product that is being sold. However, I find a better measure for that would be if you ask people to pay after they watch the movie. Because all the box office numbers mean is that X amount of people went to watch it.
Exactly.
Which I've always maintained is never indicative of quality. It's just indicative of curiosity, of interest, of intrigue. If I like a movie and you ask me to pay for it, I will pay for it. And you can then use my money as proof positive of how awesome this movie is. So that is kind of a concept that we don't think about. We look at these box office figures. We are talking about these numbers, and we try to see those as justification for how good or bad a movie might be. But at the end of the day, we're doing that because the people making these movies are doing that, right? People that make these movies, that behind the scenes make these decisions, that greenlight these movies, that we get to enjoy or critique or, you know, have podcasts about, are the guys that are looking at those numbers. And they're going, well, this made this cross this threshold, and now we will greenlight the next one. With that perspective, do you find we're in a world now, especially because, I mean, at the end of the day, Justice League underperformed. By all expectations, it underperformed commercially. Like I said initially in the beginning of the show, it is the lowest, I mean, to date, right now, as of this recording, it is the lowest grossing DCEU film in this 5-film franchise. Do you find that's going to make a difference? Do you think the DCU is going to chug along? Like we talked about, the MCU had major issues in the beginning as well. Do you think this performance of Justice League is going to be the wake-up call for DCEU, or do you think it's not going to matter because they're still going to just continue on with their initial plans, and then 5-10 years from now, we're going to talk about DCEU just like we revere the MCU now?
See, that's where I don't know. I really don't know how Warner Brothers and DCEU is going to actually work with what's happened with Justice League. With the way that the behind the scenes, I'll call it gossip and news, came out for what was happening in terms of the filmmaking process and the editing process and the writing process, a lot of it, like, Warner Brothers could easily just be like, well, I mean, this was sort of a one-off thing. I mean, extenuating circumstances, yada, yada, yada. I had to bring someone else in, yada, 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 yada. Mm-hmm. That they could easily just go, yeah, no, the next one will be fine because we won't have this issue. We'll have someone in the seat from the beginning. It'll be just like Man of Steel was in the beginning. It'll be fine because everybody will be hands-on throughout the whole process, without necessarily learning anything from the experience that, you know, things need to change a little bit, and you can't continue to have the same person directing each of your properties because they are wildly different from the previous one that you've done.
Yeah,
you have strength, you have people's strengths, you have to play to them. You can't just think that someone's a jack of all trades, because Zack Snyder is certainly not a jack of all trades.
Now we do hear that, though, right? We hear that often. Like, I remember for when BVS hit, and again, critically underperformed, there was news reports of, you know, Warner Brothers executives being shaken up, you know, things being moved around, you know, people are being restructured just to, you know, make up for that. Jeff Johns, if there's any guy that should be creative control of the DCU, is Jeff Johns. Jeff Johns, for people that don't know, again, is the guy that revitalized DC Comics. 10 years ago, I'm going to say, I think maybe even longer, he came in and he kind of updated the origin stories of characters like Green Lantern and The Flash, and essentially provided a framework for the DCU where they are now. He provided a lot of the event comics of the DC Comics. You know, he took a character like Green Lantern, who was kind of an auxiliary, kind of tertiary character, and brought that character and the Green Lantern core kind of to the forefront of DC. He could even be seen directly responsible as, you know, being the guy who brought the big screen Green Lantern to, you know, to theaters at that point, you know, product notwithstanding. But he has pull. Jeff Johns has a lot of pull in this company. However, he is a writer. He is a comic book writer. He is not a filmmaker. As of, I believe, from BVS or even prior to BVS, Jeff Johns was announced as chief creative officer of the DCEU. However, when you look at these movies, me personally, having read his comics, having been a huge Jeff Johns fan, I don't see his touches on the finished product of these movies or even these stories in any way, shape, or form. I don't see anything in these movies that, to me, go, oh yeah, I see it. I see what Jeff Johns did. I see him managing Zack Snyder. And I feel like Jeff Johns' input can only be in the writer's room. And beyond that, when it gets to production, I don't see Jeff Johns having any input. Like you mentioned, Zack Snyder's style is all over the place. His movies shift tonally. You can't have one guy doing the same thing over and over again. Right now, we talked about Kevin Feige and the MCU. DCU has no one like that. You've got one director who's been so far responsible for the majority of the films on the franchise itself. The two times... And there's, like you said, James, there's all these reports, these behind-the-scenes reports. And for people that don't know, Justice League was mired in controversy even before the movie came out. There's all these stories about the fact that even prior to anything else, there's all these stories about scheduling conflict. We've had this long-standing rumor after Batman v Superman that Ben Affleck no longer wants to be Batman, which is this anxious little nugget in the back of everyone's head that does he want to be, what is happening, like, why do we keep hearing about this?
And that one is still going,
like, and he's still going, and that's the weird part. Now we've had a second movie with him and we're in the same, you know, news cycle of Ben Affleck doesn't want to be Batman anymore, Ben Affleck will not be Batman anymore, even though he's signed on for a solo Batman movie with the director of the Planet of the Apes franchise, two of the movies, War of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Matt Reeves. And now there's newspaper headlines about the fact that he's going to be recast, that Matt Reeves is looking for a new actor to fill the shoes. And this is where I want to talk a little bit about this business, right? Marvel Studios, now rebranded very recently, what, like a year ago, James? 2 years ago?
Two, I think, now. Yep.
2 years ago, Marvel has now been rebranded as Marvel Studios, and you've got DC films, DC movies are always with Warner Brothers. we've got the MCU where their issues, again, I mentioned they have issues. I mentioned they had a lot of hiccups earlier in phase one and phase two. However, I also mentioned we don't talk about those hiccups anymore. And this is a direct result of how they handle these issues, right? As a company, Marvel, under the Disney umbrella, deal with these situations very tactfully. As a business, they handle these leaks, they handle these problems. The biggest fallout, I think the biggest controversy in the Marvel Cinematic Universe happened with the Ant-Man movie. The Ant-Man movie, which was being developed by Edgar Wright, director of the Cornetto franchise, Scott Pilgrim, so on and so on, Baby Driver more recently, which is kind of heading into worst territory this year. Edgar Wright was developing, I believe, Ant-Man even prior to Iron Man. Right, I think even prior to the MCU, he was working on sort of an Ant-Man movie. And the biggest problem, again, same story, Edgar Wright departed from Ant-Man, I think, a couple of weeks before the movie went into production. A couple of months maybe before the movie went into production, and that was the biggest controversy at the time. However, they handled it, they brought in Peyton Reed, they handled it very tactfully. Edgar Wright even said, you know, in a statement himself that, you know, this is something that I worked on, blah, 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 creative differences, blah, 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 blah. He moved away, Peyton Reed came in, Ant-Man was one of the bigger hits of the MCU for the solo hero brand new movies, and now we don't talk about that anymore. We don't talk about the fact that Edgar Wright had a disagreement with Marvel. One of the more high-profile, respected directors, who is his own sort of niche audience, who is, you know, there's a lot of fanboys, a lot of Edgar Wright fanboys, just like there were a lot of Joss Whedon fanboys, and we don't talk about the fact that one of our favorite directors didn't get along in the Marvel model. We don't talk about the fact that the Wonder Woman, you know, amazing lady who kicked ass with Wonder Woman, didn't get along with the Marvel model. And I think that has a lot to do with how Marvel handles it. Whereas, again, coming back to DCEU, Ben Affleck doesn't want to be sad Affleck. We've got a mustache controversy for Justice League where, you know, Paramount wouldn't let Henry Cavill shave his mustache. So Justice League had to rush through a CGI mustache-less Henry Cavill, which people noticed and freaked out about. We hear about these problems with, you know, directors and people bringing in behind the scenes, having to rewrite scripts and all this other garbage that I personally feel like affects the performance of a movie even before the movie comes out, because you have it trending, and just like a CEO, just like when Steve Jobs were around and Apple was a thing, a CEO getting sick plummets the stock of a company. And I like to believe that as a product of these film studios, you hear all this nonsense about a movie prior to release that will affect its box office.
Yeah, it does. I think it does. And I think you're on to something there, too, with just the way that Marvel handles things. Like, I still remember all the nonsense that was happening with Suicide Squad and how...
Yeah.
You know, like, there was reports, I think, almost every week of something new and wacky happening on that, whether it be from Jared Leto or from... there was a huge studio step-in in order to recut the film, and you know, the tonally it had to be lighter, and this was changed, and that was changed. And you look back at the MCU, and I look back over its multitude of films, and the only one that ever sticks out is the Ant-Man one, that I can remember, even there being a hint of an issue, or Joss Whedon, and that's going back to 2015, with, you know, he was exhausted. But, I mean, outside of that... That was about all we got. He's exhausted. He's not. He can't do this anymore. He's leaving after this. He's sort of done.
Right.
Or, you know, it didn't. Edgar Wright didn't fit with what Marvel wanted to do. It's not going to work. It's not a big fit. You know what? He stepped away.
And the thing too, though, with that, James, like, at the end of the day, like, we're people sitting behind computer screens reading this information. We're reading their narrative. Right, just like we watch their movies, we're reading their narrative. And I have to believe that at the end of the day, like, we're never going to 100% know what happened.
For sure.
But what I like about what you're saying is that you're saying, as far as you can't remember, I'm just wondering, in those situations, how much of the story are we really getting? And how much of it is being controlled by everybody involved? You know, and I'm not saying that as a conspiracy theorist. I'm saying that as an attribute to them. I'm saying that that's a good thing, that as a company... They're making sure that Edgar Wright isn't pissed off enough to tank them. That Joss Whedon, even though things didn't go well, they're departing on good terms. That he's not tanking Avengers 2. And I'm saying that's a good thing for that company. to handle their business. They're handling their business. They're not airing. They're ensuring and taking steps to ensure their dirty laundry doesn't get aired in public.
100%. Having a strong PR game, especially in this business, is incredible. Because as you were sort of alluding towards before, where I ended up talking about something else that I didn't mean to. If you can control if you can control what the news is and control how bad things look or appear to look, it will have an impact on how many people are going to go see your movie. If you hear about a movie that is marred in controversy and it is a mess and there is this fiasco and that fiasco, who the hell wants to go see? Like, part of me would be like, yeah, I kind of want to go see the train wreck that it is, but I mean, at the end of the day, that's all you're doing, is you're watching something that you've already heard from every news source for the past, its entire development, that it's going to be not great. Whereas you have something where it's like, oh, well, there's creative differences with the one director that was attached, but don't worry, he's still credited as a writer, everything's going fine. Mm-hmm. Like, controlling that story and at least making everyone who was involved with it, including the people that left, leave on good terms is crucial to developing something that will work and is sustainable. And that's what DC does not have, in my opinion, is a decent PR strategy for any of their news, because all of it is coming up from all these different sources and none of the voices seem coherent into what actually is happening. It's just rampant rumors all over the place.
And it's also, I mean, and it's funny because, again, while researching this show, when you go look at any website and you go list of MCU movies, you get this, you know, whip up the scroll type of length of movie, 17 movies for the MCU. The weird part about the DCU movies, there's 5 movies. And their number of upcoming announced rumor and expected movies list is just as big as the MCU, which is both startling and concerning. Because the thing that you mentioned way back in the beginning of the show is that the MCU exists today because of a well-thought-out, bigger picture. If I was to sum up the biggest problem with the DCEU is that there is no big picture, or at least there doesn't seem to be a big picture, because when you have this oversaturation of unplanned movies being announced left and right, for example, earlier this year, the Lego movie did really well. The Lego Batman movie did really well, made a lot of money. And literally that week, there was an announcement that the director of that movie was going to do a Nightwing movie. And you're kind of like, how does this fit into anything that, like, what do you mean, what? And then they scrapped the Cyborg solo movie. After the release and box office success of Suicide Squad, we got a Gotham, you know, a sequel in the form of a Gotham Sirens movie, which we don't know what's happening with now. Since that announcement, we've heard that Margot Robbie will not only be in that, reprising her role as Harley Quinn, but she will have anywhere between 2 to 3 other Harley Quinn movies, either with, without, or both with the Joker involved. Jared Leto's Joker, or there might be a Joker origin story with a totally different actor as the Joker. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's just like, we don't know what DCU is doing, we don't know what Warner Brothers is doing, and the more they try to tell us, I feel like fans, at least, and maybe even critics at this point, are just kind of getting fed up of it all. That it's kind of like, just stop talking about it, just do it.
Exactly. And like, a really, really interesting point is I just did a rough count of the amount of stuff that is coming up movie-wise between the MCU and the DCEU. The MCU has, nicely and thankfully, has 7 things that they are potentially working on between now and 2020. Nice. This is what's been sort of, like, announced. We got, like, Black Panther, Infinity War, all of these are coming up next year. Right. We know about Ant-Man and the Wasp also next year, which is, that's a huge schedule for 1 year.
And these movies have all are in production. They're being, you know, post-production. They're being completed. They've been shot. These are movies that are very much a reality.
Exactly. You got Captain Marvel, which is a pre-production.
Right.
The second part of the Avengers film, obviously that's technically filming because I think they're doing both at the same time.
James Gunn is currently working on the draft for Guardians of the Galaxy
Guardians 3. Yep. And we have the Spider-Man sequel coming up as well. By comparison, there are 23 potential projects for the DCEU. And as I've said to you in the past, it's like the wet spaghetti model. They're just throwing a whole bunch of noodles onto a wall and just seeing what the heck will stick, which doesn't make any sense. Like, how do you run a universe like that where it's just, no, we're going to do this. Oh, people don't seem to really care about it. All right, we'll take that one away. All right, we'll do this one instead. Oh, people don't seem to like that. Fine, that one's gone. Oh, Harley Quinn, you want to do five movies? Sure. We're going to book five movies for you right now. We're going to attach some random names for now. And
plus an animated Harley Quinn standalone show where Robbie will be the voice.
Oh my God.
It's, I mean, and again, and I wanna, and the thing that bugs me as someone who does write about these movies, who does talk about these announcements, who does do podcasts of when there's breaking news like that or trailer drops and things like that, I feel, maybe me not personally, but the industry that I'm a part of, that I try to kind of be a part of, we're kind of implicit in this, that I don't care about what the announcements are. I don't want to nitpick, what one executive says and then spiral that into a news cycle where it's like, oh, there's going to be seven different Harley Quinn movies. And I feel like because that news cycle dominates, because you get those clicks and you get that free PR, essentially, at this point, I feel like that could maybe also perpetuate the problem that DC... It's almost like having a free focus group, right? DCEU is going, we'll announce something, see how people respond to it, and that's the and then we'll go based on that. If people respond positively, well, that's the direction we'll go. If people respond negatively, we'll veer away from that. And I mean, because I can't help but feel that this is ruining our perception of these movies, right? Because there's bad movies that get great press, and we walk in and we go, oh, that was all right, that wasn't so bad. We don't come out with the vitriol and anger and hatred that we seem to come out of DCEU movies when they suck, and we hear for months and months prior to watching the movie that, hey, this is probably going to suck. So, yeah, I mean, now, if we can go back to Kevin Feige, because at this point, like you mentioned, there's a bunch of different DCU movies coming out. A huge slate. Yeah. I don't even, I mean, for example, another very terrible sort of example of the creative issues behind DCU is the Flash movie has lost, I believe, 3 to 4 directors. 3 to 4 amazing directors. And to this day, we still haven't an idea of if it's in pre-production. Is the script being developed? Is there a director that's on the shortlist? We have no idea, besides the casting of the main hero and the supporting actor, Billy Crudup, as, you know, Ezra Miller's father, Barry Allen's father. We have nothing on that movie. And I want to kind of now go back to Kevin Feige, because we talked about the fact that during Phase 1, Iron Man, Jon Favreau was the champion. He was the guy who was heralding this MCU. Today we know that the real man behind this whole thing is Kevin Feige. Kevin Feige is now, for people like us who know about the behind the scenes of these movies, he is a god at this point. What's funny to me is when you look at Kevin Feige's IMDb, if you can think of any superhero property prior to this shared universe starting in 2008, if you go back and look at the movies that this guy has been a producer or executive producer, associate producer, co-producer of, you kind of understand why the Marvel Cinematic Universe is considered objectively, you know, critically, popularity-wise, appeal-wise, the better of these two franchises. Because Mr. Kevin Feige was associate producer with Laurel Shoulder Donner, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, back in 2000, when quite possibly the first ever mainstream popular comic book adaptation movie came out with X-Men, directed by Bryan Singer. Now, obviously that was the Fox universe. This was predating, this was when Marvel had all their properties with different studios. But also in 2002, he was executive producer, uncredited, of the Spider-Man movie. This was the Sam Raimi film, the first ever Spider-Man live-action feature film commercial adaptation, which, again, we've all grown up on. We all look on fondly, despite the fact that there's been 18 other Spider-Men since then. Daredevil, he was a co-producer of. I believe the Ang Lee Hulk, he was an executive producer on. He was executive producer on Punisher. Blade Trinity, he jumped in on. This man has been part of the pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, superhero movies, as recently as Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer, which was in 2007, 1 year before he launched the MCU with Iron Man in 2008.
So, if there is a man that you want attached to a comic book movie,
right?
Oh my god, like that's all he's done.
This man is literally all he's done. This is not a guy that came from Goonies, or this is not a guy that came from some award-winning movie or some indie movie that he, you know, made his bones on prior to. This guy has started his career with and is now essentially the godfather of shared superhero universes. Let's not even get into the most recent Disney buyout of Fox 20, you know, Fox and their properties. But right now, this is what DCU doesn't have, right? This is what's missing. This is what, like you mentioned, multiple voices, multiple styles, multiple people screaming from multiple mountaintops about the things that they're doing that do not in any way correlate with one another. And that is the issue.
Exactly. And it's a lot of it is coming from, you have a lot of people that are generally associated with money being your main spearheads. Like, you look over at, I was just perusing the list of just the breakdown of all the MCU films, and I look at just who's listed as producer of all of these films, and I go, okay, at the start it was Kevin Feige and Avi Arad because they brought this on together,
right?
But the only name that remains constant throughout this is Kevin Feige. Through every single thing, whether on his own or maybe teamed up with one other person, especially in the case of Spider-Man, because that was a shared property. But then I look at DCEU, and there's four names on Man of Steel, two on Batman v Superman, two on Suicide Squad, four again on Wonder Woman, four or five on Justice, like, and they're different people almost every time, and none of them seem to know whether they're coming or going, who's going to do what, or why something should change.
And we hear this, the most recent news of the fact that, executives are being shuffled around at DC, people are being let go. And I don't know why a lot of people are reacting with the sense of, they're course correcting. I remember those reports during BVS as well. That the Warner Brother executives are getting reshuffled, people are being put in charge, other people are being removed from powers of position in order to streamline the process and figure out what they're doing. That was 2016, early 2016. That was 2015 when BVS was announced. And since then, I don't see any changes. I'm not seeing the changes that I keep hearing about. The headlines are dominating that everything's changing at DC. Yet, since Justice League was released, we had this multiple Harley Quinn animated stories break. We still have Batman as a huge question mark. Is Ben Affleck Batman or not? And this is, again, in the weeks post-Justice League. So it's really hard to kind of rely on this franchise. We'll still keep coming back to it. And I liked one thing that you mentioned, James, really quickly. You did mention that at the end of the day, the money is kind of like the outlier, right? The essentially deciding factor of how much these... The continuation of these franchises, these movies, the next step, the progression of these stories, it depends on how much money these movies are making. I mentioned Justice League was the lowest performing movie of these five DCEU films. I went on to Box Office Mojo. Thank you, by the way, for introducing me to that. And I did a quick, rough sort of calculation. I rounded down. I took the first five MCU movies and kind of just took a look at their total box office, domestic and worldwide gross. And you have the first five movies, obviously, of the MCU were The Incredible Hulk, that no one likes to talk about for some reason. The Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, the first Thor, and Captain America, the first Avenger. These were the building blocks of the MCU that culminated into the Avengers. If you take a look at Box Office Mojo, again, rounding down from the total numbers, the domestic was $1.1 billion of all these movies, and the worldwide was $2.2 billion. Now, the thing that kind of surprised me a little bit, and I'm sure James will fact check these numbers, so if there is a retraction, you will get it at the end of this podcast as an add-on recorded thing. But I'm looking at the DCU of their first five movies, and their domestic combined was $1.5 billion, and their worldwide unadjusted was $3.7 billion. And if we had to ask the question of what the hell is the DCU doing, why are they continuing on a path that is so inconsistent, so messed up, so seemingly unsure of themselves? Wouldn't this be the answer?
I think so. Totally. Why do anything? I mean, if you're going to make money hand over fist, why do anything? Now, the only thing I would like, sort of as a posit or an aside to your numbers, is your movie or your, like, the DCU includes not one, not two, but three team up movies.
Yeah,
three of them.
Yeah.
Whereas the ones that were in phase one of the MCU, every single one that you added up was a standalone movie.
Yeah, of course.
Factor in Marvel's The Avengers, that worked out to, it adds an additional $1.5 billion?
On its own.
And that's the thing. Like, we're talking about, that movie on its own did fantastically, amazingly everywhere, and it adds to your thing. I mean,
that's the other thing too, right? That one MCU movie, domestically, rivals all five. The Avengers, Marvel's Avengers worldwide rivals that of the domestic collections of the first five DCU movies.
Yes.
Which, now, when you back up, in the beginning of this show, I was talking about the fact that I find DC more relatable. I find those characters to be a lot more well known. Who the hell knew Iron Man before the movie Iron Man?
For sure.
Whereas everybody knows Superman.
Yes.
You come back to this and you go, there's a movie, there's a live action feature film movie with Wonder Woman, Superman, Batman, and then some. That was the first movie. That was BVS.
Yeah.
You've got the other classic heroes get added to that. How is that movie not breaking box office records? How is that movie not toppling every other thing shot with a camera in the world in existence? And that's the kind of interesting thing that I find really interesting, is that we talk about MCU having quality, but that quality doesn't seem to collectively reach the half-hearted efforts of the DCEU. At the same time, you brought up the analogy of the, you know, the pasta method of just sticking up, throwing everything on the wall, see what sticks. If this is DCEU's collections with just strands of pasta sticking to the wall, I would love to see a dish. I would love to see a well put out, completed final product where the quality matches the box office. The quality matches the effort of the makers put into it, not just in terrible headlines or company executive shakeups. I would like to see how that pans out. And I don't, at this point, like I said, I feel like the wild card element is a Kevin Feige. I don't feel like there's a DCU Kevin Feige. Zack Snyder architect the whole thing, great. Due to personal reasons, due to maybe business decisions of this movie underperforming, I don't believe Zack Snyder is going to be helming another DCU movie for a while. I don't know what that does to his production credits. I don't know what that does to his involvement in the development of these movies in the future. But with him gone, Patty Jenkins is coming back for Wonder Woman 2. James Wan has completed the solo Aquaman movie. I don't know what would James, just wrapping this whole thing up in a nice little nutshell, what would you want, or where do you see, or what do you hope, and who do you get at this point to fix, course correct, or kind of bring this back to the level of excitement that we would have had if things weren't like this with the DCEU?
I think, honestly, and this will tie back into how we started this podcast, I think what the DCEU needs is they need to get their creative people together, not just the ones that are currently attached, but they need to bring in someone like what they did with Patty Jenkins, and give them time to work on their project, not bang out these movies as quick as humanly possible to capitalize on getting box office numbers. They've had a frantic release, and I mean, as I said, like, Zack Snyder's been attached to every single one of these things in some capacity since the beginning. You can't have someone like constantly jumping from project to project to work on something else. You need time. Time is necessary. Like, you cannot poop one of these out in like 2.5 months and go, yeah, we're filming it, you know what, print it, good, it's good, it's good, it's fine, it'll make money. That's, you can't run an extended universe like that. You can't have shoved story threads in just so that you can tie it to the next movie that you're going to crap out in 2 weeks so that you can tie it back and, oh, it's a continuation, and we're introducing these characters vaguely. We don't have time because we have all this other stuff that we want to do so that we can keep making more and more movies. There's a difference, a huge difference, I think, in the fact that the MCU model takes time in a different way. It's not the same person directing every single film. It's not the same writers on every single film. They've given people time to work on their project, write their stuff, get it all proper and the way that they want it, and then film it with different people working on each one, the only constant being Kevin Feige, the one dude who's just looking after it and making sure that things flow and fit together right. That's what they need. They need someone who's going to be the one constant between the projects and bring in creative people from across the film world and get writers that are different each time to work on something that's a little bit different than the last one, or right to that director's style so that it can flow properly and give the other people involved in the other projects enough time to work on theirs as well. It's more of like a each one is its own compact bubble while they're still attached by the one common thread, which is Kevin Feige going back through every single producer credit on every single one of these films.
Jesus, yeah. I saw that and I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this guy did nothing else but this. So James, who do you get? With the upcoming slate of the DCU movies, what movies are appealing to you? What movies do you think would contribute to this, to the enhancement of the shared universe? And second of all, who do you get? Who do you get to direct these movies? And who do you get to architect the whole thing?
You personally. I think me personally.
Yeah. Kevin Tsujihara comes up to you right now and goes, I heard you on the podcast, James. You're the man. How do we fix this shit?
Oh, man. I would love to get Ben Affleck to actually direct something.
Ooh, okay.
Whether it be his own Batman movie or something completely different, like,
I'd love to see Suicide 2 by Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
Just because you look at what he did with The Town, and you look at what he did with, you know, some of those, like, you know, Beyond Baby Gone. And I think, yeah, an Argo. I can see that. And keep in mind, as much as I like Ben Affleck as a director, I was like one of the maybe 0.2% of people that didn't like Argo. But I can see that fitting in with the Suicide Squad sort of ensemble.
Yes. I'd also like to suggest maybe taking like almost what Marvel has done with a little bit of their directors and bring someone up who's mainly only done some indie films recently. Mm-hmm. Taika Waititi being notably one of the top ones to bring on. Like, he was a fantastic choice for Thor Ragnarok. If DC made that kind of choice, maybe not with Taika per se, but with another up-and-coming indie director, like someone who directed... it would be so weird if they got the director of... what's it called? The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Yiannopoulos?
Oh, I can't even say his name.
Yiannopoulos, something like that. To do a film, like, it would be a weird, wacky thing, but, like, it would be an interesting thing. Like, I think that's sort of what I've almost enjoyed about recent Marvel films, is that they've let people do their thing.
I'd love to see him, again, and I haven't seen either of those movies, but based on what I've seen in the trailers, I think he could do, like, a nice, like, The Question. Like that,
yeah.
Like Kevin Smith always champions The Question movie, and I would like to see that. Maybe give Guillermo del Toro his Justice League Dark.
Oh my God! Please let him have it.
Like, what is your problem? Like, and that's the other funny thing about DCU too. when there's these big directors that seem interested in their projects, they tell them to screw right off. And it makes no sense to me. Do you understand how excited I was when I heard when Mad Max Fury Road was winning all the damn Oscars?
Oh my god.
And someone was like, Man of Steel 2, I think George Miller might be interested. I'm like, why isn't he getting all the money? Why aren't
Sign him up now.
All of the money.
Yeah.
For this movie.
Sign him up.
And George Miller is one of those guys that takes his time, right? Like Nolan was saying, he takes his time. That dude spent how many years doing the next Mad Max movie? At this point, I mean, is there any other movies that you're excited about in this upcoming slate of Marvel movies? Sorry, DCU movies? Whoa.
I mean, yeah, it's fine. I want to be excited about Aquaman. I'm just not. I don't know if it's.
What if they start marketing it like the Shape of Water kind of thing? You know, this
then I'm in.
Misunderstood, you know, watery merman falls in love with Earth Lady. I don't know.
It'd be such a weird. With Jason Momoa?
Yeah,
speaking English now?
Yes, exactly. Or he's just his voice is so gravelly deep that you don't understand him. Like Shades of Dothraki that comes out.
I mean, Wonder Woman 2, I'd like to see if it follows up and lives up to the hype of the last one. I don't know enough about Shazam to really be excited about it. I like who they've announced for Shazam.
The director?
But, well, the director
Chuck,
who's attached to it.
Zachary Levi.
Chuck.
Yeah.
Yes. Hawk, like, those would be... Oh, yeah, and then he's not going to appear in it anymore, and it'll start on his own. So, like, it's... Again, we're going back to that whole well of things being yes, then no, then yes, then no, then yes, then...
Yeah. Well, the one consistent thing is that Dwayne The Rock Johnson will be Black Adam probably in time for my grandkids to be born.
Yes, definitely. That's guaranteed. So, everything's happening... In 2020.
my ideas would be I would get, like, if MCU is bringing up the guys from the indie film guys like James Gunn, like Taika Waititi, I would get DCU to do the complete opposite. Like there's been enough. Christopher Nolan has legitimized superhero movies. He's at least for Warner Brothers, from that perspective, he's given these guys enough room where it's like, yeah, if WB is willing, this is a universe you can play in. If George Miller was interested, let him do it. Guillermo del Toro was interested, let him do it. I would even want to see, I think WB, that was, Blade Runner 2049 was WB too, wasn't it?
Yes,
they had a hand in that, right? Give Denis
a friggin' movie.
Like, holy crap, give him, like, a pathos-ridden, sort of crazy, ridiculous, like, symbolic film to do. Like, get a character, I don't even know. Like, he wants to make Dune, and you know who we got from Mars? Martian Manhunter. Let Denis Villeneuve do a Martian Manhunter origin movie. That would be ridiculous. that would be, like, just, you have the money, you have the legacy of Warner Brothers as a label. Recruit the top A-list directors, give them movies they're interested in doing, go back into your exclusive characters. Marvel has had to hustle left and right to buy back their characters or link up with Amy Pascal and Sony Pictures to get Spider-Man. You have all your movies, you have all your characters in your stable. Find guys willing to reach back, pick a guy out, make those movies, follow the MCU model of solo hero movies, big massive team up.
Honestly, and I think that would be a really cool idea too, is just be like, okay, just like put out I don't even care if it's an email. Put out an email to every single director that you know and just be like, here's all the properties we have.
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Choose.
Yeah. Choose this. Or even make it like a smaller list. You don't have to use the entire catalog because maybe fine, you want to do an extended universe, you want things to connect. Fine. Here are these characters.
Can you imagine? Pick one. Can you imagine if WB and DC Comics just sent back issues, like a truck full of back issues each, to major directors they're interested in, just to their house?
Here's the catalog.
Dump truck full of comic books just landing on some dude's driveway. That would at least warrant a response, would it not?
Yeah. What resonates with you?
So my last pick, and this is one I've actually put some thought into, based on King Arthur, I want Guy Ritchie to do a Green Lantern Corps movie.
Yes.
Because that guy plays well with ensemble class and massive, immense, complicated storytelling, which I think is what Green Lantern Corps needs.
And I think even, like, looking just briefly, remembering Guy Ritchie's films that he's done, most of them are dealing with multiple leads.
Massive ensemble cast, and multiple storylines converging into, like, a Seinfeld-like crescendo at the end.
His type of storytelling and his way of filming movies, especially with, like, the jokey narrated flashbacks, would work so well and would be so, so different and interesting and fun to watch, instead of just, like, we're starting at the beginning. Here is this. Here is this.
The funny thing is, the DCU model so far has not been that. It's not we're starting at the beginning. It's we're somehow going to put you smack dab in the middle of something.
Yeah.
And try to expect you'll get it, and then we'll go back and maybe do solo hero movies? Because, I mean, Cyborg, we need to see more of him. Like, what? Like, who is Aquaman? Why is he... Where is one... Like, it's... I understand that, you want to do something different and set yourself apart from MCU, but there's a reason why those movies have worked. And it's not a formula. Like, if you're going to say that everything that, like, every superhero origin movie is a formula, then you're wrong. Because there's a reason why those movies are told in that manner, right?
Exactly.
Not every movie is Spider-Man Homecoming, because you can't backdoor introduce a character in another superhero epic and then spin him off.
And I mean, that's a huge point. You're talking about Spider-Man, a character who has been developed in movies since 2002.
Yeah.
You know, we're over 10 years of developing this character. We don't need to develop. We don't need to give him a raw origin story anymore. It's fine.
But here's the thing too, right? Based on that point right there, you're telling me Spider-Man the Cinematic Universe Spider-Man film has been around since 2002. So if you're telling me that we're so oversaturated since 2002 of Spider-Man movies, imagine how much more that applies to the character of Superman, Batman, because there's been how many movies of those guys and how many different versions of their origin stories. Give me a Superman movie where he's already Superman.
Exactly.
Let me see, like, Henry Cavill's rawest deal in this entire situation is, as much as you liked him from the beginning, as much as I like him now because I feel he's grown into it, he's constantly been robbed of his solo movie, of a movie where he gets to be the character in a movie that heralded this whole thing, and he keeps getting gypped in favor of flashy, you know, shallow sort of grandstanding where here's Batman and here's Wonder Woman and here's three other guys you knew nothing about. And it's like, no, build on what you have. Stop trying to get to where someone else is.
Exactly. And but, like, don't do the opposite of that with characters that we don't know. Like, it's fun. Like, I'd love to see you just throw me into a Superman movie. Don't give me his origin. Again, I don't care. I don't need it. We all know that he came from another planet. It's fine. Drop me into an adventure with him specifically. But don't do the opposite when you have someone like The Flash, who, besides a random flashback in Batman v Superman, has not been on screen, and expect me to understand and get to know him in rather quick amount of time so that you can carry on with the rest of the movie. It doesn't work. It didn't work in Suicide Squad. It will not. It does not work in Justice League.
Yeah. All right. I think we've been beating this race to death. And And I love that despite the disclaimer in the beginning that we will not nerd out, we've spent the last 15 minutes going, who do you want to direct this movie?
Yes. Yeah. And then again, we dove into what worked and what didn't work with the specific movie, which we said we weren't going to do, but we totally did anyway.
It's hard, right? It's hard to separate that, because, I mean, if you take a look at the Rotten Tomatoes reviews of certain things, it's really hard to separate what a movie did inside of itself and what it did outside of itself. And I find it a little ridiculous that we even have to talk about the outside of a movie. I find it ridiculous that you have to talk about, like, when we buy a new iPhone, we are talking about the apps, we're talking about what it does, what it can do, the features, the interface. We're not talking about the engineers who designed those features. We're not talking about, well, the thing is, you know, his wife left him, right? So there was that period where he couldn't develop the smoothness of this feature. That's why it's a little choppy. We're not talking about that. Again, and I'm sure we're cinephiles, so we know about this world. I'm sure in the tech industry, people are talking about that. I'm sure people are aware of a guy who designs an app and what company he was at before and why he left and why he came onto this company and why he designed. I'm sure there is things like that in the specific industry that you do follow. My point is, other industries aren't subjectively creative like movies. And if the inner workings of that ends up affecting, influencing, and ruining that experience for you, personally, even though I would probably be out of a job, I would rather not know about that. Tell me who's being cast. Tell me who's writing the script. Show me a trailer. If there's problems, deal with it as a company. Keep it to yourselves. Handle them before they become a thing that audiences will watch and remember as they're experiencing the creative thing that you just put out.
Exactly, and issue a cohesive statement that aligns with everyone else. Don't let it spread. Like, just literally come behind a unified voice. A unified voice in this game is key.
And if you compare, I mean, we're talking about Marvel and DC, but let's talk about Disney, the branch of Marvel. They've gone through worse changes than, you know, script issues, mustache problems, scheduling conflicts. The Han Solo movie literally had directors replaced in the 11th hour.
And exactly.
We are no longer taught. That is no longer the news cycle of the Han Solo prequel movie. Ron Howard stepped in, Instagrammed a bunch of crap to forget about who was directing that movie before, and now we're moving on and looking forward to the Han Solo movie.
Exactly. Even worse than that was Rogue One. Like, Rogue One.
Yeah.
Was 11th. That was 11th, like 11th minute.
Yeah.
That was like no time left. Let's get this in, and still we're not talking about that. We're talking about the fact that Rogue One was relatively decent.
Brilliant movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. It was great, and you don't notice any of these problems. You don't hear about them. It was just like it happened. We're not denying it happened, but here's a movie. Yeah, and exactly, and that's where DCEU doesn't have that. It falters behind its own weight and baggage.
To sum up, DC Extended Universe and the makers behind the DC Extended Universe and the filmmakers who are considering to be a part of the DC Extended Universe, please, 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 get your shit together.
Get it all together, put it on a backpack, get it all together.
And on that note, James, thank you so much for making the time to appear on the show again for a longer-winded discussion than we had last time. Let people know where they can get a hold of you to tell you how wrong you are for liking DC over Marvel.
That's fair. I understand. I accept everyone's opinions. You can find me everywhere at Jamatuzzi. That's my handle on practically everything out there. Yeah, please, feel free to tell me what's wrong with my opinions on things, but that's, you know, I don't have to listen to you. But also, thank you, Shaw, for having me on this wonderful podcast. It's my second time, and I hope that you'll have me back again.
I'll think about it. I'm gonna gauge the public reception to this episode, especially your tour mentions, and we'll go from there.
Fantastic. That's fine.
Throw things on the wall, we'll see what sticks.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, James, once again. For everyone else listening, thank you so much for listening. This was the Split Screen Podcast. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play Music, and a bunch of other podcasting applications. Follow the podcast on Twitter at splitscreen_pod. If you do not have a mobile device, you can go onto the website www.blankpagebeatdown.com to listen directly on your browser or download an MP3. Follow me personally on Twitter at TheShahShahid, Instagram, Facebook as well. Best place to let me know and have any sort of conversations you want about anything movie-related, film-related, TV-related even, is on Twitter. If you like what you guys heard, you want to see more stuff like this, please leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps people find out how awesome the show is. I'm tooting my own horn. And if you have any other feedback, again, let me know. If you do want to be a guest on the show, like James here, and be eternally grateful to me forever, definitely get in touch with me on any of those social media platforms. Let me know if there's a movie remake you want to discuss, a topic you want to discuss, and you find yourself to be something that you need to say or you want to analyze, feel free to get in touch with me. We can workshop it, and we'll go from there. Once again, this has been an episode of the Split Screen Podcast. My name is Shashi. Thank you once again for listening.